Welcome to Holden Village. Today, in the fabulous fireside room, today's speaker is Michael Pellett, and he will be speaking on impaired discipleship, Mark 6 and 7. So let's listen in on Michael Pellett.
Welcome, Rockies and Rockettes. If you've been here before, you know what that means. This week we are looking at discipleship as understood and presented in the Gospel of Mark, and what Mark tells us about what it means to follow Jesus, and that we've been using as kind of our chief illustration for that understanding of discipleship the parable of the sower and the seed in Mark chapter 4. Because, as I've said, what's important about that parable is not the sower or the seed, but the soils, and the way the soils respond to that word which has been cast upon it. So that the way the soils respond is one of Mark's primary images or metaphors for discipleship, and that one of the problems of discipleship that Mark sees and particularly points out among the disciples that are the followers of Jesus is that often discipleship is the response of what happens to the seed that falls on rocky ground. And thus we came to the understanding that Peter, it kind of personifies that rocky ground kind of discipleship. And Peter, of course, means rock. And if we'd kind of anglicize Peter's name, we'd understand Peter as Rocky Johnson. So we're looking at Rocky Johnson and all of us as Rocky Johnsons, and what Mark has to say about our kind of discipleship. Today we want to talk about discipleship, and again, how hearing is involved in that. And the key to all of this, I think, is the healing of the deaf mute in Mark chapter 7, verses 31 to 37. So that's kind of the key about where I want to get to today. So I want to tell you where I want to get to, and then hope we get there. And now I'm going to back up a little bit to say, but now how do we get up to the end of Mark chapter 7? And I want to start back in Mark chapter 6. And look again at what happens to Jesus in his hometown. Hometown is Nazareth, which is part of the Galilean area. Here's the Sea of Galilee. Here's the Dead Sea again. Now, remember in the first time that we went through the Gospel of Mark, remember, Jesus did his Galilean ministry around by the sea, went up to the mountains to call his disciples, and then came home to Nazareth, where, as we learned yesterday, right, he had trouble with mom. Right, and all of those incidents there that happened at Nazareth. After that incident at Nazareth, we see that Mark repeats this cycle again. Jesus goes out to all the communities around the Sea of Galilee and teaches. He goes up into the mountains to be away by himself for a little bit, in retreat, if you will. And then he comes back home to Nazareth, and this time again, he has problems with the hometown folks. And so this is how Mark chapter 6 verse 1 begins again. He left that place and came to his hometown, right? So you can see this cycle is repeated, coming back to the hometown, and just like the first time, things didn't always go so well. What may happen this time? Well, we're not sure. and his disciples followed him. Okay, the disciples followed him. Right? Following is that notion of our key way of seeing discipleship for Mark. And so when Mark talks about the disciples following him, that's always a code word or a cue for us as readers to say, okay, Mark's going to be talking about discipleship here, because he's talking about those who follow him, who follow Jesus. So there's going to be something said about discipleship. So what happens? On the Sabbath, he began to teach in the synagogue, and many who heard him were astounded. Okay, we've got hearing again. That casting out of the word, just like the sower casts out the seed. So Jesus is again teaching. Jesus, the sower, casts out the word, the seed. And how is it received by the hometown folks? Well, they're astounded. They're amazed. They're kind of puzzled and perplexed and all of those things at the same time, right, is what's there with that word astounded or amazed. And so they start asking questions. They said, where did this man get all this? Where's all this coming from? And their other question, what is this wisdom that has been given to him? Where and what are the questions they're asking? Now, there should be one other question that they ask, which is the most important question. But they're not asking that one, because, as we'll find out, they're rocky disciples. So they're like stupid disciples. But you, remember, are the smart disciples. So you know that the real question to be asking is not where or what, but
who.
Who? Oh, right! What a group! Of course, who? And as smart disciples, you know that the answer to that is way back in Mark 1:1. Right? Who? The Christ, the Son of God. They're still asking where. Like, where does he get this stuff from? Who or where is his authority to say this and all of that? The where question goes back to that notion of authority. Where is the origin? Where is the source of all of this? And of course, there the irony to that is that this question has already been answered. Where was this question already answered?
Baptism?
Nope. Come on, smart disciples. The last time he was at home, back in chapter 3, the stuff we talked about yesterday. Didn't you get it? Remember? The whole issue surrounding authority. Where is Jesus' authority? We only had a chance to touch on that just a little bit at the end, right? That whole notion of the house divided. Is Jesus' authority and source of what he says, is that from God or is it from the devil? Right? Is Jesus possessed by God or is Jesus possessed by the devil, to put that quite right, that little bracketed section that we didn't get much of a chance to talk about. The where question was already answered that first time Jesus was home. But you see what happened? They didn't get it. Right? And precisely the reason that they're asking where and what is an indicator that they didn't get it. And moreover, an indicator that they didn't get it is they're not asking the most important question, who? Right? And that a follower of Jesus, a disciple, recognizes that the key question is always centering around who is Jesus? Who is this Jesus that I should follow him, that I would follow him? That becomes the first question that's asked. So since they didn't get it, then all of a sudden they start really getting off base in terms of asking questions. In verse 3, is not this the carpenter, the son of Mary and brother of James and Joses and Judas and Simon? And are not his sisters here with us? You know, like all of a sudden, you know, who is totally forgotten in terms of what's important? And they're just saying, hey, isn't Jesus just folks? Just one of us? Just the kid down the street? We know his family. What's the big deal about him? And so now their response, the last part of verse 3, and they took offense at him. And if your Bible has a little footnote there, it says that offense can also be translated stumble. And again, I prefer that. And they stumbled. Or the Greek word there again would be, and they were scandalized. The word scandalized was that term in chapter 4, verse 17, in explaining the parable of the soil of what? Rocky ground disciples are always scandalized. And so we're right back into that situation again of what? The people of Nazareth are scandalized. They stumble. They trip and fall over the who question. Who is Jesus? And they find what he says in that sense totally unacceptable because they can't grasp who he is. Now for us as disciples, as smart disciples, knowing who Jesus is, we see even more dramatically how scandalous that can be. Because who is Jesus? If Jesus is the Christ, God's agent to bring about God's salvific will, and this Christ, as we know, goes to the cross to suffer and die, just think how scandalous, right? Do we stumble at that fact? Do we stumble at who Jesus is? And are we scandalized by that? Does that make us, again, Rocky disciples? That we, like Rocky Johnson and like the hometown folks, have a very tough time following Jesus once we know and come to grips with who Jesus is? That's the question and the challenge that Mark presents to us in this first opening section of Mark chapter 6. But having again established for us who Jesus is, then we can go on to see what discipleship entails from that. And another section comes in here. And I'd like to look at chapter 6, verses 7 to 13. And for lack of a better title, I'm going to label this section Jesus Evangelism Program. And just to get you thinking a little bit and to challenge you, what I think is happening here is that Mark's understanding of evangelism, or what he understands Jesus' evangelism program to be, is basically the exact opposite of how we understand evangelism programs today. In some senses, I would think Mark is telling us, folks, when it comes to evangelism, you've got it all wrong. That most of our evangelism programs today or concerns are, how do we get people into the church, right? How do we get folks out there to be members of our church, of our congregation? Right? That's what most evangelism programs are about. Or to use that insiders-outsiders language I used yesterday, our evangelism program is the concern of how do we get outsiders to become insiders like us? Because after all, we're much more comfortable if what? We could get all those outsiders to come inside where we are and be just like we are. Because that would be very comfortable for us. We're very secure. We like that a lot. So everybody, come on in and be like me. Evangelism. Jesus has a whole different understanding of discipleship. His concern, and what Mark wants to push, is for Jesus, evangelism is how do we get the insiders outside? How do we get the church out there into the world? Out there to where the people are? That if we are truly disciples and followers of Jesus, we have to be going out there. And so, how do we get us out there? Not how do we get them in here? And of course, at that point, you can see right now how we're back to rocky ground kind of thinking, right? Because I don't want to go out there, right? It's risky out there. It means that I am going to have to be vulnerable, right? I'm not going to be comfortable. And so how am I going to live out there with all of that risk and so on and so forth? Well, we've got a few indications here as Mark outlines for us very briefly Jesus' evangelism program. Beginning at verse 7, right? Jesus called the 12 and began to send them out two by two. Here, a little contrast to what we have in Matthew and Luke. Right? Matthew and Luke, the sending out is the sending out of 70. But in Mark, we only have the sending out of the 12. Why do we only need 12 disciples in Mark? Because again, for Mark, right, the disciples, and again, Peter, Rocky Johnson, as the key disciple, serve as that indicator of rocky ground. And so, whether it's the one disciple, Peter, or the 12 disciples, or 70, or 100,000, doesn't make any difference for Mark. The point is, right, that Jesus is calling these rocky ground folks. Right? Jesus is calling us, who are rocky ground kinds of disciples, and sending us out. Right? Note again, sending us out two by two, not alone. Right? We never go alone. There is always that sense of accompaniment. The discipleship is always a sense of community. It might be a small community, right? A community of two, but it's always a community. We are accompanied. And what? Began to send them out and gave them authority over the unclean spirits. The Greek word there is a sense, in the verb, is a notion of keeps on giving them authority. Again, emphasizing that notion of accompaniment. It's not that Jesus just gives you the word or the authority once, and that's it, and you'll never hear from him again. But it's continuous, right? Jesus keeps on giving, keeps on accompanying. We are never alone, left, or forsaken. And we need to hear that, right? Because again, this is a very risky, vulnerable venture. And to know then that we are being accompanied by Jesus and by his authoritative word is what gives us strength and enables us to do this. In verse 8, he ordered them to take nothing, right? And the word there, order, is a very military kind of term here. The image is almost, if you will, General Jesus addressing the troops, right? We're ready to go. And so what do they do? And the irony here, right, you know, is you would think usually when a general addresses the troops, you say, all right, troops, you know, take your guns, take your rations, right? Take everything you need. And here, General Jesus is telling the troops, okay, troops, don't take any food, don't take any rations, don't take any weapons with you. Right. So you can see in that sense, it's a contrast to any military kind of undertaking, right? It's not that we're going out there to do conquest. Right. I mean, yes, we go out to do battle. In Mark, there is the battle against the demonic forces, the unclean spirits, injustice, all of that. But that is a battle in terms of, again, healing and wholeness and winning people for God. Right? It's not a notion of conquest. And if you're here next week, a little sneak preview. We'll look at that more closely in chapter 10 with that contrast between what it means to, as the Gentiles practice leadership by lording it over others, and as the Christian community practices leadership by a servant who lifts others up. That's already indicated here in this sense of, right, we don't take with us the kinds of things that the typical soldier would take out. Right, that's, so there's that ordered notion, so we're thinking army, but this is a very different kind of army, a very different kind of militarism, if you even want to use that word. We're not talking conquest. Something very different, as we'll see, with different metaphors. Again, what they are to take is they do take a staff, right? No bread, no bag, no money in their belts, but to wear sandals and not to put on two tunics. Okay, so in Mark here, you do take a staff and you do wear your sandals. Kind of good advice if you go on a hike, right? Even here at Holden, right? If you're going to go hiking, take a walking stick, wear shoes. The interesting thing is that in Matthew and Luke, both of them say, as well as no money bag and no food and all of that, Matthew and Luke say no staff, no sandals. Now, what's going on here that we would have this change? And we see here again Mark's different theology and understanding of discipleship than we have in Matthew and Luke. To say no staff, no sandals is a reflection of Jewish piety and practice when you go to the temple. The Berakoth, in terms of temple worship, says a man, and here I do mean man because after all in the practice, right, women couldn't even get into the temple, they're in the outer courtyard, but a man who could get in closer to the temple. A man may not enter the temple mount with his staff or his sandal or his wallet. So in other words, I mean, that's, you can see that Lutheran practice is very different. If you want to leave your staff behind, okay, your sandals, okay, but please bring your wallets. You can leave them at the temple, but please bring your wallets. Right? But for Matthew and Luke, they want to emphasize that this sending out is like the way one worships in the temple. So that evangelism is like your temple worship. Mark is far more radical than that. You wear a staff, or you have your staff, you have your sandals. Why? Because for Mark, the model of evangelism is like Exodus. Evangelism is the Exodus event. If you would look at Exodus chapter 12, verse 11, these are God's instructions to Moses about how to get the people ready for the Exodus out of Egypt. And it's the instructions for how to prepare the Passover lamb and all of that. And then he says, and when you eat this meal, have your sandals on your feet and your staff in your hand, because we're going to have to blow out of there very quickly, so you got to be ready to eat and run. That's what we're about. And so Mark is saying, evangelism, Jesus' program of evangelism and discipleship is like the Exodus. We have to be ready to go at a moment's notice, to eat and run, because you see, following Jesus and discipleship does not have the kinds of comfort and security of being centered in a temple. There is no temple. Where our worship of God happens and where it takes place is on the way, on the run, on the road. Or back to what we talked about yesterday, as Jesus looks around, right, and says, here is my mother, my brother, my sister. And where is here? Here. I mean, right? It's where you are. So here is here today, and it might be in Wenatchee tomorrow, in Saskatoon on Thursday, or whatever day, right? I mean, but if you're always looking at wherever you're at and saying, here is where we worship. Here is the church. There is no building, there is no temple, but it is the people and the community around us. And so in that sense, discipleship means that we are Exodus people. We are always on the way. And wherever we stop, that is where the word happens. Evangelism happens. And so Jesus continues on, right, in verse 10. Since we are these kinds of travelers and people on the way, we need to practice hospitality. And hospitality, if some of you know anything about evangelism programs, at least within the Lutheran Church, that's a big word, right? How do we as churches practice hospitality? How are we hospitable to those folks that come in to see us, right? In other words, how do we practice hospitality in terms of being hospitable hosts? But Jesus' understanding of hospitality for Exodus people is what? How do you practice hospitality as guests. Because we're not hosts. We're basically on the way. We're always going to be guests. And how are you hospitable guests? Wherever you enter a house. Right. Note again that indecisive, right, you're on the way. Wherever you enter a house, stay there until you leave the place. Right. You just don't go jumping around or saying, oh yeah, it's nice sitting at this table because these people are kind of interesting and those people over there, well, they're not eating as much food and I'm hungry, so I'm going to go over and sit on that table, and then right, or this house, that house, whatever. Right? It's stay put. Stay where you're at when you're in that place. And then, when the job is completed, move on. Or what if you are not welcomed? Verse 11. If any place will not welcome you and they refuse to hear you. Note again what not welcoming means. Back to that sense of hearing. If they are totally unreceptive soil, and if they do not hear you, then what? Shake off the dust that is on your feet as a testimony against them. Not in the sense of a curse. I think sometimes we read that shaking off the dust as a curse, but it's not a curse, but it's just simply saying, well, you didn't hear us? I'm moving on. Because what? I'm an Exodus kind of guy. We're on the way. We are Exodus people. And so we have the task, and when the task is completed, or the task is not able to be completed at that time, we move on. That's practicing the hospitality as guests. Now, I want you to think about that a little more, and I'm going to pause here in a moment for your responses to that, but just a few more things about guests, right? That maybe as churches, as congregations, you're concerned about, are we good hosts? But have you ever thought about, are you good guests? What kind of guest are you in the communities in which you live? What kind of guest is your congregation in the community that you're in? Just think about that as a question. Or to put it a bit more negatively, what difference would it make to the community around you if someone would get in a bulldozer and just raise the church building? Would it make a difference? If it doesn't, obviously, you're not very welcomed as guests there. Right? You don't make much of a difference to folks. But just think about that in terms of guesting. The other thing about guesting, I thought about this a little bit, in terms of Jesus is much more the guest than the host. Think about it. He's always mooching off of Mary and Martha for meals. But do you read anywhere in the scriptures where, and Jesus said to Mary and Martha, come, let me take you out for dinner. No, right? I mean, poor Mary and Martha. Or, right, think about the Zacchaeus story. Jesus is going through Jericho and all of a sudden stops and says, hey, Zeke, we're doing lunch today. I'll be over at noon. The perfect guest who invites himself over to your house. Did Jesus ever take Zacchaeus out to lunch? I don't think so. Or Simon the leper, or all these other places and people with whom Jesus eats, right? Part of the notion for Jesus and evangelism could be the understanding of what we would call table fellowship. That part of our evangelism, part of our guesting, is that notion of with whom do we eat? Or again, maybe at the congregational level, think about Who comes to your potluck suppers? And again, does the community even feel invited to your potlucks? Or to take this notion as guest, whose potluck suppers do you attend? If your congregation throws a potluck, sure, you'll be there. But what about if someone else has a potluck? With whom are you in table fellowship? And that kind of metaphor, again, of table fellowship, of guesting, of eating with all sorts of people, right? Again, the crowds and who comprises the crowds. Would you like to eat with the crowd? That's Jesus' understanding of evangelism. Jesus sending us out, right? Saying, no, we're not insiders, but we as church, as followers, as disciples, must go outside and be out with them and eat with them and live with them and then spread the word there with them. Risky, vulnerable stuff. Are we scandalized by this kind of evangelism program? Or do we act on it? That's the challenge that Mark presents us, I think, in this section of the story. But let me stop here a bit and get your thoughts, reactions, comments on what we've done so far. Please.
I'm very happy to hear your explanations.
Es muy contextualizado a la situación de la América Latina.
And this is very relevant to the situation in America Latina.
Por ejemplo, el mandato que Jesús hace que fueran de dos en dos.
For example, the commandment that Jesus gives to go by two.
Nosotros lo comprendimos más cuando en el contexto de la persecución.
We understand that very well in the context of persecution.
Teníamos que decirle a los hermanos, vayan a visitar las comunidades, pero no vayan solos.
We always had to tell people in our church to go and visit the communities, but never go by yourself.
Siempre que vayan dos,
always you should go at least two.
Porque así se ayudaban, como usted muy bien lo dijo, se requiere de muchos problemas y se necesita la ayuda del otro.
Because the two could help each other and lots of problems that come in going out to a community could be resolved by two, but not by one.
Y es exactamente también lo que dice, siempre estamos en el camino.
Yeah. What you say about, that we're always on the road is very true.
Nosotros utilizamos otras palabras.
We use other words to describe this.
Diciendo que todos somos refugiados.
We say that we're all refugees.
Todos nosotros somos refugiados porque estamos de paso en este mundo.
All of us are refugees because we're moving through this world. On the road out, whatever.
Any other comments? Yes.
In our town, the ministers went two by two and visited the taverns. I don't know how that turned out. They never asked me to go along.
It wasn't two for one night at the bar.
Oh, no.
That's interesting.
Speaking of that, we have a pastor, I don't think he's doing it right now, but he spent most of his time in the taverns. And that was his purpose. still goes out among the street people.
But here, I mean, and that's good. But here again, right? It's not just the pastor who's supposed to do that, right? This is again the sense of ministry for disciple, right? The disciples are doing that. It's the kind of thing the congregate, right? People in the congregations are out in the taverns or street people or, right, wherever, you know, whatever outside means at the here that you're at, right? And being guests at that point. I mean, you see, again, it seems to me what's so radical about this for Mark and how I think it's counter to many of our evangelism programs and notion is, again, that the distinction between, like, temple and exodus, right? I mean, for Mark, the notion on evangelism and what that is about says buildings, if you will, of any kind are really unimportant, right? We're not interested in getting new members so that we can keep our programs going and remodel our sanctuary or fix the leaky roof and all of that. I mean, Mark is far more radical to say, when you don't have a church building, you don't have to worry about how we'll fix the leaky roof. I mean, that's one way to get rid of leaky roofs, don't have buildings. Now, I'm not going to push that all the way either. But the understanding of an Exodus church, an Exodus community, right, is simply saying wherever you happen to be and people receive you, that's where the church will happen, right? That'll be in somebody's house, in some school, gymnasium, wherever, but that's church.
I think one of the things that sort of lit up for me when you just said that is that I think maybe with some of your churches too, but I know with Medardo's church and the church that I served in Phoenix, when in a sense the church became a house where refugees could come in, we were very involved in the sanctuary movement. When the church became a house, then it became a wonderful place. In other words, when it became that place where people who were on the road were disciples, and many times we had to see that these people are disciples of Jesus coming, and they're looking for a house. And it happened that the only house that could protect them was the church. And I know there were many times in Medardo's experience too, when people, in order to save their lives, had to go in the church, and it became sort of a house.
And also look at that connection between house and the understanding of table fellowship. Right? Now look at with whom are we eating in that house? Right? All those disciples, all those people, any neighbor who is in need of our help, right? Whether that's shelter, refuge, food, I mean, that's what happens at houses.
One of the things too that I noticed that when our church was finally converted to see it as a house or congregation, was when we finally, you think about your churches, where is the holiest place in the terms of religiosity in your church? Is it the altar? Is it the pew? For most Lutheran churches, no, it's not any of those. It's the kitchen. And there are certain people that guard that kitchen like a military army. And when the refugees were finally welcomed, say, this is your kitchen. You can cook food here too. This is your place. This is God's place. This whole church, you know, the kitchen everywhere else. Then the place became a wonderful place.
You're not trying to just a $64,000 question. How do we work in our congregations to make the shift from temple mentality to Exodus or refugee mentality? I hear a little bit from Jim as to how that happened in his congregation.
I don't think there are any set or pat answer. I mean, I think how we work at that is simply through practicing this kind of Exodus discipleship. I mean, when you practice that understanding of here are my mother, my brothers, my sisters, and when you start practicing how do we get folks out there rather than how do we get folks in here, I think, as Jim indicated, the understanding of church and even that building takes on a whole different notion of what it is. And the building does not become the be-all and end-all that shows our status and who we are as Christians, but it just becomes one more tool, one more gift that we use in our Exodus discipleship.
I think one of the things that strikes me as this word scandal is to realize that when you do that radical thing of kind of switching completely, that there will be a sort of point where there's a scandal.
Yeah.
That, I mean, sort of, there need to be a few people in the congregation that understand this, and at least the pastor needs to understand it, or some other leader, maybe the pastor doesn't understand it. A few need to understand that there will be this point of crisis. And so that's when really faith needs to start operating, because then when it kind of breaks through that point of crisis, then things start to happen in the opposite way. You need to be ready that it's going to be hard.
And that understanding, I mean, again, to say this is risky, vulnerable stuff, and people, you know, are always, of course, uncomfortable with that, but there again, in some senses, Jesus' assurance to say, well, of course following me is risky and vulnerable. What else would you expect? Remember, right, we're the smart disciples, so we know that already. So to say, to engage in this venture will again expose our vulnerability? Yes. But we also have God's promises. We know who God is and that God accompanies us on the way. And so we'll get through this. There's a comment, I think, over here. Someone wanted to say something.
Okay. You were saying that Matthew and Luke had a different notion of the temple.
Yes.
Would this notion support our traditional practices and understanding of churches, or is there another way to understand Matthew and Luke as also sort of subverting our practices?
I think they want to subvert some of our practices as well. But what I see happening here, a little bit of some technical stuff. If you hold to Mark in priority, right? Mark is written first, Matthew and Luke written after and following Mark. It seems to me that what Matthew and Mark want to do, or what Matthew and Luke do, is recognize just how radical Mark is, and so they want to soften him up a little bit to make him a little more palatable so people can say, you know, oh, you know, for Mark, you know, oh, that's so tough. But when you can read Matthew and Luke, you go, tough, but maybe. So I think Matthew and Luke try to make Mark, try to soften Mark. That's my hunch. Okay. Time is always the enemy for me. Let's go to chapter 7. Very quickly. Just a few phrases here that I want to point out. This is again the controversy between scribes and Pharisees, Jesus and his disciples, and the issue is that the religious leaders are saying, You folks aren't observing the tradition. And they were talking here about a practice. In verse 3 of chapter 7, Mark says, "For the Pharisees and all the Jews do not eat unless they thoroughly wash their hands, thus observing the tradition of the elders." Now here again, in the Greek, that word observing is the same word that was used in chapter 3 when mom and the family wanted to seize Jesus. Right? So again, you see Mark is punning here, and it's not just that these folks are observing the tradition, right? But they are clinging to the tradition. They're grasping the tradition. Or if you will, it's the kind of thing that it's saying the Pharisees were clinging to the tradition. Right? That kind of notion is what that word is, right? How you would seize or grasp someone. Right? The picture is, right, I mean, who, to whom do you cling, right? I mean, to what do you hold on to for dear life? Do you hold on to the Word of God, or do you hold on to the human tradition? And that's what the whole issue is in chapter 1, verses 1 to 23. Right? What do you cling to? Right? Yeah, I mean, observed is just too nice a word there in that sense. Mark really wants to push it hard. They are clinging to this. And because they cling to it, what happens? Their indictment in verse 8. "You abandon the commandment of God and hold," again, right, "cling to for dear life to the tradition." And so again, you can see that for rocky disciples, and what sometimes becomes scandalous is what? Do we cling to our traditions, or do we cling to God's word, God's promise? Right? It goes back in that sense to what are you listening? Are you listening to the tradition, or are you listening to God's word? Right? Which word catches your attention? To which word are you attuned? That's the issue. One more thing I want to say about that. In verse 9, Jesus says to them, and this is just oozes with irony. It says, "You have a fine way of rejecting the commandment." And again, fine way, that term in Greek is the word kalos, which means beautiful. And right, and so Jesus is saying, "You have a beautiful way of doing your song and dance around God's word in order to cling to the tradition." Right? And don't we, within our own traditions and denominations and practices, know how often we can do just a beautiful song and dance, wonderfully choreographed, in order to make sure that the traditions are kept at the expense of God's word. We can do beautiful ways of stopping up our ears. Right? It doesn't have to be ugly. We can wear wonderful earmuffs or whatever, hats. Right? But that, I mean, this at this point, this verse just oozes irony and is that indictment against us and our traditions. Okay, to get five minutes to do the punchline, right? What can you say? And this is one of my favorite miracle stories because it's just loaded with good stuff again. the key here in verse 32 is they brought to him a deaf man who had an impediment in his speech. Okay, so that we're, our key metaphors here is the interrelationship between hearing and speech. And we're starting off with the with just the basic physiological fact, but it doesn't hit you until you think about it, right? If you know someone who is deaf or has been deaf from birth, they also have difficulty speaking, right? Because, you know, as crazy as it at first seems, right, if you can't hear, you really can't speak. Right? If you can't hear, you blah, 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 or whatever, right? It's just babbling. It's nonsense. It is incommunicable. And so, right, the problem at times with our speaking, I mean, I think this is Mark's point, which is just brilliant, right? The problem at times with our speaking and our witness and our proclamation is what? We can't hear. We are hearing impaired in our discipleship. So no wonder we can't talk. No wonder we can't proclaim. No wonder we can't evangelize. So that in that sense, to say, well, you know, I'm no good at speaking. I can't, you know, I can't proclaim the word. I can't be a disciple. What should I do? Listen. That's what you should do, right? That's the first. And so then the miracle account, Jesus heals this person, verse 35, right? And immediately his ears were opened, his tongue was released, and he, what? Spoke plainly. Or another way of saying that is, right? Spoke clearly. Every word was understandable. Why? Because he could hear. That what God does, right, is unstops our ears. And that the problem with rocky discipleship, right, the difficulty with Rocky Johnson and with many of us is that what? We are hearing impaired. Our ears are stopped up by something, by whatever it might be in this world. And because we cannot hear the word, then of course we cannot speak it plainly, clearly. And so the key for discipleship that Mark wants to present to us is that what? It is clear hearing that empowers, enables, and equips you for clear speaking, clear acting. Right? Again, we usually think that with discipleship and all of that, the first thing we got to do is talk, talk, talk. You know, talk. I'll talk, you listen. I'll talk, you listen. No, discipleship works the other way. It's we listen, then talk. Listen, then talk. Hear what God has to say, then we can speak clearly what God has said. Okay. That's the, I mean, that's where all, if you will, all of chapters 6 and 7 are leading to this. This is the key for Mark in this section about what discipleship is all about and why it often fails. We're hearing impaired, and therefore all our other impediments follow. Okay, the bell has rung, so I'll let you go for coffee or whatever you'd like. If you want to stay around and talk a little bit, that's fine with me. I'd be glad to do so. Tomorrow is text study, and on Friday we'll come back and look at double dosage discipleship, or we'll take the visually impaired version.